Good morning and welcome to our Thanksgiving, our special edition Jump the Shark Thanksgiving podcast of Preventing Grace. We're not actually jumping the shark.
But that's what happens when people do a special episode. Well, not we.
No.
If you didn't grow up in America in the 80s and 90s, you might miss the reference.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right, so.
Actually, I do have some idea.
Every time you have a very special episode, you know that a sitcom is getting ready to jump the shark.
Yeah.
Right, so this is our very special Thanksgiving.
I feel like we jumped the shark though, just by doing a podcast at all. Probably.
As people, as persons, we've jumped the shark.
We maybe, but also we just caused the whole genre to jump the shark by joining in. That's what it means.
Yeah.
So we are going to have a super special episode together where we talk about things are not that important because it is Thanksgiving.
Well, one important thing, but
yeah, one important thing. We're covered in snow. We're snowed in, and we have to dig out so we can go buy milk. And it looks like the entire town is shut down today, so that's very exciting. So we probably have some tips for how to survive snow with a lot of children who want to go in the snow, and we also want to talk about Thanksgiving. What we're going to eat, and you have an Anglican church in what is it called? Where?
GAFCON UK.
Where was the Anglican church founded? Remind me. Where?
England.
England. That's what I was looking for. The Church of England. Update. Because.
Well, actually in Jerusalem with Jesus. It was.
Oh, the church was founded. No, but the Anglican church wasn't founded. Oh, really? Are we going back that far? Okay, so Matt's going to say some things about that because I don't even know what's happening there. And I know the world is longing to be updated about the Anglican situation.
Yes.
Why don't we start with that?
Okay. So the Church of England is interesting that we're celebrating Thanksgiving. And I saw the meme.
Yeah, that's a great meme.
That.
You're welcome, America.
Right, America owes Anglicans a debt of gratitude because if we had not persecuted the Puritans.
The Pilgrims. Who became. I'm really tired.
Math is hard. History is hard.
The Puritans,
right.
Came to America as pilgrims.
Because we pushed them out, so they should. Yeah. America owes Anglicans a debt of gratitude.
You're
for that.
Welcome.
Yeah,
you're welcome. We're here for you, man.
But the Church of England is not known for its zeal with regard to orthodoxy.
It does have zeal, but not for crumpets and vestments.
And collegiality.
Collegiality.
Right.
And tea time.
Right.
Tea timey.
So in particular, the present Archbishop of Canterbury, who ascended to the throne of Lambeth Palace under the pretenses of being an evangelical because he attended one of the larger evangelical / charismatic churches, and that's where he became a Christian, but has in fact proven to be very...
Not a Christian?
Well, he came in seeking to unify the church, which has been shattered because of the blessing of same-sex unions and ordination of those who are living in same-sex relationships and consecration of bishops living in same-sex relationships, which the vast majority of Anglicans around the world have objected to, and many Anglicans in England have objected to. But he wanted to find a way to have unity, institutional unity, by not really taking a stand on this so that both sides could be within the same group. And what that essentially does is reduces the question of sexuality to a non-essential issue. It becomes, you know, what you think about drinking wine or some question that really doesn't have the importance to cause any kind of division. So if we all say, well, yeah, I have this position on sexuality, but my brother over here thinks it's fine for his two men in his parish to be married, then we can all, we can just disagree about that, but still gather around the altar and do mission together. That's kind of
agree to disagree.
Yeah. And of course, the problem is that Paul describes this sin as one that will, if unrepented, prevent someone from entering the kingdom of heaven. So it's any sin that is damnable is not adiaphora. Anything that God speaks clearly about is not a non-essential issue. When it's in the scriptures, rejecting it is defying the living God, and so you can't do that. And so, anyway, I don't think he would have been appointed Archbishop of Canterbury had he not come in with the intent of trying to bring together the two sides, when the only way really for the church to be safe and to be healthy is to discipline the heretics who are leading people to hell and leading people into sin. And that's the only solution, but he's not going to take it. So anyway, in England now, there's...
their situation is complicated because their state and their church are joined.
Right. Yeah, so there's
so
that.
So it's not like America where we could just say, all right, we're done. In America, we go on our merry way in a more regular way.
Right.
But for to be Anglican in England is a more dicey...
It is the state thing. Church. It's
yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of... There's political and religious aspects to the... And national identity aspects to the...
To the business of being Anglican.
Right. Exactly. And many parishes, many church buildings where people are worshiping have been around for longer than America has been, much longer than America has been around. So it's not as easy as an American saying, "Well, I don't agree with the Episcopal Church, and I'm gonna give up my 50-year-old building and move to
100-year-old building we gave up.
Right. Okay. We'll move down the block.
Yeah.
it's a much more different situation. So anyway, there is a group of Anglican clergy in England that are being very brave and courageous in their refusal to go along with the strategy of unifying and getting along with those who are leading people to hell. So they have joined, or the international Orthodox Anglican group called GAFCON has launched what's called GAFCON UK, United Kingdom, and many Orthodox clergy have joined that. And the latest controversy comes because this group, last week, I believe, maybe it was the week before, published a paper detailing the violations in England, in the Church of England, of Lambeth 110, a resolution from 1998, the Lambeth Conference in 1998, which is a conference of all Anglican bishops. And in that conference and in that resolution, it was declared that same-sex relationships were unbiblical and could not be approved. Mm-hmm. And yet, in England, this paper detailed a good number of violations of Lambeth 110, which are violations of Scripture, ongoing, undisciplined, mm-hmm. without any kind of stopgap, any kind of attention being drawn to them, any kind of discipline given to them from bishops or the Archbishop of Canterbury. And boy, that was people went insanely angry. It became insanely angry about this list and calling it a witch hunt. I really think that there are some, even conservatives, and I'm going to get to this in a minute, in the Church of England who think, and there, this is true in the United States Episcopal, in the Episcopal Church in the United States as well, who think that collegiality among clergy is the same thing as church unity.
Yeah.
Who think, well, why are we being so rude and mean and causing division
mm-hmm.
by naming these names?
So the list was a list of names of people who had...
Yeah, names and instances of,
so
of it, violations.
It wasn't just sort of a general, these things have happened.
No.
It had names put to them.
No, no.
I mean, that's that's pretty gutsy.
And the Orthodox clergy who are not part of GAFCON UK, who are faithful with regard to human sexuality, have been among the loudest voices being angry about this list. And they're calling it divisive. They're calling it a witch hunt. Divisiveness is not identifying and shining the light on sin and false teaching. False teaching is divisiveness.
Yeah.
It's not divisive to stand up against
false teaching.
That's what shepherds do. When a flock is being devoured by wolves, a shepherd says, "Hey, look, a wolf. Let's get him."
That's just mean.
But in this case, no. But the but there are other shepherds in this, you know, this fold here, who are angry at the shepherds identifying the wolves. And they're kind of teaming up with the wolves to attack the shepherds.
Yeah.
It's astounding that any... I was going to use a different word. I'm not going to say
it's astounding. Is it really astounding? I don't think it's really astounding.
No, it is. It is because it just says that some people on our side, on the scriptural, biblical side of things, who I respected, I still do respect, who I thought had some... I believe know the Bible, still believe getting along in the Church of England is more important than identifying these things that are killing people, that are driving people into the darkness. I don't understand how anyone can read their Bible and be angry with shepherds doing what the shepherds are doing in England.
Well, I mean, I can't give you a good reason, but I do think that the human desire to avoid controversy is very powerful.
I'm sure the English desire to do that is even more
powerful than the American. Yeah, it's even more powerful. One. And the desire to not be on the losing side of something, because that's really essentially what pastors, priests in England are going to have to understand, is that they're on the losing side of an issue, and there's no temporal happiness for the church,
right,
in this regard, and you have to embrace that,
right,
and decide that you want to do the right thing rather than
we are going to be hated.
Yeah, you're really going
to be hated.
So there's no way around that, and you should stop worrying about it. Which is, it, I think what was useful for us as we came up through seminary, and you in particular, is that you were always hated. You
that's
never.
That's not very nice. People love me by the end of the
seminary. By the end, but in the beginning, you were never sort of theologically beloved. You've never been in that position, and so you haven't really lost anything, because you're a pugilist by nature. Whereas for some who are not, who really have relationships with people and want to get along and carry on with the mission of the church, it's hard to join up with the losing side, I think. But that's really what's going to be required of Anglicanism,
right.
I think. We have to embrace the loss, the fact that we're the losers this.
Well, there's a really strong push on the part of people who believe in sola fide, or I'm sorry, sola scriptura, who want this kind of collegiality and unity. To say, well, you know, look, there are people on the other side who really take the Bible seriously and just have a different interpretation than we do. And so if they're holding to the principle of the Bible being supreme and inerrant and infallible, but they're just coming to a different conclusion about what the Bible reveals, we can't really say they're heretics, can we?
Yeah, actually we can.
You could, yeah, right. You could say the same thing about Arius. You could say,
yeah.
You could say the same thing. I mean, how far does that go?
Yeah.
I mean, because what happens next when someone wants to find legitimacy in the scriptures for, you know, a male who's 50 being with a female who's, you know, 14, which someone might do if they take a reading from maybe Luke chapter 1 and 2 with Joseph and Mary, who people say Joseph's very old when he married Mary, you know, 30 or whatever. What do you do with that? Do you then, oh, okay, well, you know, it's that's biblical, you know.
If you look at the Old Testament and decide that incest is fine.
Yeah,
because the Bible.
Half-sister of Abraham is Sarah, so.
Yeah, or so Tamar, and, you know, you look at...
If you take the narrative sections and use it as
theological or doctrinal.
Right, and use it to override the didactic sections, the epistles and the commandments. That's usually the attack, but that all that subtlety is lost on the vast majority of people. So when an Orthodox guy says, "Hey, look, you know, these are just people who are looking at the Bible a different way than we are," that's the tack they're taking to try and normalize this new kind of interpretation.
Really, what you do have to say about some people is, you're reading it wrong.
Yeah.
You may be reading it, but there's a wrong way to read it,
right,
and you're reading it wrong. And I'm sorry that that's so, and I understand that you have good motivations maybe and that you're trying your best, but in this case, your best isn't good enough, and the church is not going to bless your reading of Scripture either.
Right. The Bible does have actual meaning, objective meaning. It's not subject to our interpretations. There is an objective meaning to it, which our interpretations try to arrive at, but
sometimes the
existence of two different interpretations does not mean that there is no right interpretation.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the modern mind gets so confused.
And I think good Christians are anxious and confused and worried about being wrong, and so they don't pin themselves to the truth.
Yeah.
They know the truth, but they're not confident enough,
right,
in their own biblical study, which again so much could come back to proper study and preaching,
right,
and pastors who are trained enough so that they, when they stand up in the pulpit, they are sure and certain of what they're saying, and they're not just fluffing it up or making the best of a bad situation of not having studied enough during the week. If you stand in the pulpit and you are not 100% sure of what you're saying, then you know it's the proper interpretation and exegetical work, then you probably ought to go on sabbatical. And
well, there are times you have to say, look, there are some equally valid interpretations of a given text. That can happen. It's not to say that never does happen.
But it's not every week.
And it's not, and it certainly isn't with regard to this topic.
To this topic.
Right. Sexuality couldn't be clearer with regard to
sexuality. It's usually like, this word can be translated this way or this way, and when it happened in James and Hebrews for you, that both meanings of a word did not change the meaning of the text at hand. So it's few and far between that.
Right. I remember this when this started breaking open in 2003 in the United States. And when people, I started blogging in 2006, but I remember the first time I really said, this person who is compromising, who's an Orthodox believer, Orthodox pastor, he's compromising with wolves. That was when all hell broke loose against me and against those who were saying the same kinds of things. Then that's when the Orthodox side starts eating itself up. When you have the fight between those who want to compromise with heresy and those who want to call it out and destroy it is usually what I think Satan uses to water down and weaken the side of those who are trying to bring clarity and orthodoxy to the fore. I remember the people writing to me saying, "Well, no, this pastor, this bishop, this priest he loves Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, hey, look, you know, we might disagree about sexuality, but he loves Jesus. He can say the creed. He really does believe in the resurrection. I don't care. I don't care. You can believe in the resurrection. You can believe in the Trinity. You can say the creed. But if you are okay with two people of the same sex getting married, quote unquote, someone who's in a relationship like that being ordained, you are a heretic. You're not a Christian.
Yeah.
You are headed to hell yourself because you're leading people there, and you need to repent. There's no gray area there. I don't understand where the gray area is coming from, other than the gray matter in people's minds, which is becoming a fog and blocking out the rational thought.
It's very difficult, very upsetting, right, for Christians to have to point to other professing Christians and say, "You're not a Christian." Well, I know it's not hard for you, but it's hard for, I think it's really, so I mean, in an evangelical sense, the Jen Hatmaker thing, I think, is really upsetting to people who think, how can this particular error, theological error, of same-sex mirage, which is my favorite word for it, how can that rise to something that actually cuts people out of the church? How that can't be so. You know, we have so many other issues that are more important, like racism, sexism, Islamophobia, and you are bigotedly trying to exclude people for just loving people in their own way. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I think Christians who really are Christian are so confused that they can't fathom that it would be okay to be that intolerant.
Right.
You know, because tolerance is the god of this age, which of course is
intolerant. And always confused with, well, doesn't Jesus love sinners? And yes, he loves sinners. That's exactly the point.
Yeah.
He loves people who are committing adultery so much that when someone comes along and says, hey, adultery is good, he wants to drive them out of the church because he wants to save the people who are committing adultery.
Yeah.
He loves people who are caught up in drunkenness, whatever, so much that if someone were to come along and say, drunkenness is good and you need to keep doing that he would want them to be driven out of the church to save the drunken people. And the same thing is here. He loves people who have same-sex attraction so much that he wants those who are leading them into hell to be driven out of the church. Mm-hmm. That's how much he loves them.
And he's not worried about the, you know, at least in the New Testament, Jesus wasn't worried about the feelings of
false teachers.
He was, he didn't want, you know, you to even have a coffee with them.
Right.
So that, I mean, it's very difficult. It's difficult for Christians, and I think you need to be more sympathetic.
I'm not sympathetic at all. I think it's difficult. I don't think it's difficult. It's not difficult.
It's not difficult for you.
This is not a relative thing. It's not, there's a clear issue. Should we compromise with people who are taking others to hell? Yes or no? there's no haze there. There's no fog there. There's no, should we worry when they get upset when we identify what they're doing? No. Mm. No. That's great. I'm glad they're upset. Let's make them more upset. Let's get them very, very angry.
You're just a bad person.
All right. Well, anyway, we probably beat that.
So horse today, yeah, we're praying for England.
Definitely. Yeah, please do pray for England. Pete Sandlin, James Pace. These are pastors there. Pray for GAFCON UK. My mind is going blank on names, but pray for GAFCON UK because they're going to be bearing a lot of trouble in the coming months and years, most likely. So we've been through it here, but I do think there's just the culture of England makes it more difficult.
Yeah, I think it was a relatively easy thing for us, and the amount of suffering that we endured was essentially not suffering, I would say. I was thinking about it the other day. You know, losing property in the U.S. is, it's the chance to suffer for Jesus by, like, having your blood pressure taken. It's not that much suffering. It's unpleasant and irritating, but we haven't really suffered.
Well, I think some churches have suffered because they didn't. We landed softly. We lost our church, and we landed in a bigger church, and with a rectory and a nice piece of property. There was work involved with very little pain. Other churches who lost their property, that's
much more painful.
Yeah, much more painful. And some of them have not done well. So.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't, when you, that's the heartbreak, is that when you take a stand for Jesus and you leave your property and you're persecuted, you aren't promised a big congregation that goes on to mega church size.
Right.
You might have your church end up not panning out. You might have it fail. And that I think is an increased grief. And but, you know.
Right. Exactly.
I was really, you know, we've carried on with the work of the church in the time since we've left the Episcopal Church. And it's not just, you know, onwards towards glory.
Right.
So, you know, we've got to pray for each other. And Christians around the country, you know, we need to pray for each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that this would be a good moment to talk about Thanksgiving and be more cheerful. So tell me, you were asking what we... Tell me first, how did you celebrate Thanksgiving
growing up
a child? Yeah.
Let's see. We were, you know, it was never cold. I was grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas. So, you know, in Corpus Christi anyway, and I think they may be different in some parts of Texas. Well, I know in Central Texas you have actually changing of the seasons, but in Corpus Christi it goes from green and then immediately to brown in the fall. And the weather goes from 100 degrees to, you know, 80 or 70, and I guess it could get down to 30 every once in a while, but it's very warm. And so, you know, my mom wants weather. She wants to see the weather. So beginning around Thanksgiving time, it's, you know, she would decorate the house so beautifully, and it would look, well, actually she would do it at Halloween, but then after Halloween she would decorate the house for Thanksgiving, and it would look so beautiful and wintry if you're inside. Yeah, she would make it look kind of fallish, and you go outside and you start sweating, but inside it was really nice. And she would, my mom is just, it's just a consummate
her house
interior
looks like,
decorator.
Yeah, like Southern Living Magazine, I think. I've seen like spreads in magazines that are not as beautifully done as her house.
Right. So my dad's, if we were in Corpus that year, my dad's mother, my grandmother, would come over, and she's a great cook, and she would cook, she would do the turkey and the gravy and the mashed potatoes and all the stuff that you normally have for Thanksgiving. And it was, I just loved it. I loved Thanksgiving at our house. And also, we were Anglican, but we didn't do the Advent thing. So as soon as Thanksgiving dinner was over, then it was time for the Christmas festivities to begin.
That's one thing I can't wrap my mind around. You can't understand why people don't want to call out heresy in the church. I don't understand. Celebrating Christmas from October 31st until December 26th.
It's just so dark outside of here, especially. You wouldn't want to be happy.
Well, but Advent is happy.
Advent's not happy.
I don't.
Advent's about.
But see, Christmas doesn't make me feel happy, so I don't.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
I know, it's kind of cool. Anyway, besides that, so our Thanksgiving was kind of a classic, except for the weather and the location where you look outside and see palm trees, but it was the classic American Thanksgiving.
Mashed potatoes, gravy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so you asked me, how did I celebrate Thanksgiving growing up? And I don't really think that I did. I think I might have been at school most of the time. We did have, like, Canadian Thanksgiving and then maybe American Thanksgiving, and we had to eat it in the dining room. Because in school, you'd go through a line. Ivory Coast, Côte d'Ivoire. You'd go through the line for breakfast and dinner, but at lunch you were assigned to a table, and you sat with those people every day for maybe a month or something. But for Sundays, you had your Sunday table, and you had to sit in family groups on Sundays. Except I was an only child, so I always filled in other people's Sunday tables. And you had to eat with those people every Sunday for the year, I think, maybe for a whole term. And so on Thanksgiving, I think it was Sunday tables. You had to sit with your Sunday table, which was unsurprisingly a lot more awkward and sad, the Sunday table. I remember being acutely homesick on Sunday tables. Then during the rest of the week when you were kind of mushed in, it wasn't by family. But the Sunday table definitely emphasized to you that you were not at home, not with your family, and that you had no siblings. So good luck to you.
Here's a substitute family for you. They probably had good intentions, it sounds like.
Yeah, no, I don't think that they set out my school in no way thought
to make you
homesick. Let's make it worse for everyone. No, this was a good intention, but boarding school is a study in good intentions that send people into
all kinds of places.
So I don't remember Thanksgiving, and certainly we did not. I don't think I was home for Thanksgiving much, and in the village there was. Well, it was certainly we had chicken. No, I don't think I ever saw turkey in Africa. But we came home to the States a couple of years, we would gather with my whole extended family in Oregon or California. And I had something like 16 cousins or 19 or something. And so that was really fun.
So you did have some taste of
American
Thanksgiving, right?
But so I get on board with the Thanksgiving thing, but it's very hard for me when, as soon as Thanksgiving is over, the push to immediately decorate for Christmas, I don't get that.
Well, that's when the spray snow would come out, and my mom would and spray the corners of the windows with the fake spray snow. I love that stuff. But now I'm looking at
our
windows.
Windows are actually snow. Covered with snow, which is also traumatizing. So I would like to offer, before we talk about our Thanksgiving menu, I'd just like to offer a couple of tips for if you have a lot of children and you have to take them into the snow. Here's how you can do it.
Okay.
First, you can not get out their snowsuits ahead of time. You can leave them in bins in the basement. You can forget to buy milk the night before so that everybody's angry because there's no cereal. I'm just describing our morning so far.
This is so far our morning.
You can let them just go down and try to find the snow boots and the snow stuff in the bins themselves and trash the basement so that when you go down there, you're going to be really traumatized by the level of destruction.
Right.
Then you can fight with your children about whether or not they have to put clothes on under the snowsuits. Because, you know what's comfortable? I'm just going to put on this snowsuit over my
underwear
t-shirt
or whatever.
And my underwear. And, you know, socks are really hard. So I'm just not going to do socks today. And then I'm going to go in the snow, and the snow is going to come into my boots. I'm going to be out for about 30 seconds. After it took me 45 minutes to get into the suit, I'm going to start crying. I'm going to come in. I'm going to drag snow into the house. I'm going to scream and cry because I want hot chocolate, but there's no milk or marshmallows for the hot chocolate.
What would you say the average length of time for children having been... They take 30 minutes, 40 minutes to get the snowsuit on.
Yeah.
How long do they stay outside?
I'd say they stay outside no more than 7 minutes.
Yeah, and they come in.
Some children last a total of like 3 minutes.
Right.
They come in. And there's a lot of crying because it's cold and their hands are cold.
Snow.
And their feet that had no socks on are cold. And then they're angry. And then as soon as they get warm, then they want to go outside again. And so you begin the process again. And that's your snow day. That's what you do for
It's great.
The snow. So
it's going to be awesome.
It's going to be a great day. So tell me what we are going to start prepping for Thanksgiving, though, pretty quick here.
Well, we've got to buy a turkey. That would be the first thing we need to do. That would be the... But we, you know, sadly, our relatives aren't coming in this year, so we don't have...
We're going to have
to usually buy a huge turkey, but...
We'll buy a small turkey.
I'll buy a small turkey. Smaller turkeys are easier and better to cook anyway, but we miss our...
But it's going to emphasize to us our loss. Have,
yeah, more people.
Our isolation.
Right.
It's going to be like the Sunday table at boarding school for us.
Right. So
and not maybe that, not
but bad. I always brine now. I mean, brining. I'm a convert to brining. You basically a brine is salt water. You one part salt, four parts water, and then you put spices or whatever you want. And
you
what
put
happens is
sage.
Yeah,
that was amazing.
Well, what? Yeah, I put sage. There's different brining recipes, but you basically submerge the turkey in the brine water. Some people say, well, you can only do it for 6 hours. Some people say, no, you can do 12 hours. I used to time it. I don't time it anymore. I guess if you do it too long, you can come out with skin that won't crisp in the oven, and you want the crispy skin. So I try not to do it longer than 12 hours. But essentially what happens is the as the temperature regulates... Okay, I'm trying to talk science here. We should get Alton Brown to do this because he knows the science.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But the water.
History's hard.
The liquid.
Math is hard. Science is hard.
The liquid works its way through the turkey, even the meat itself, the breast meat, for example, and the taste. It's really, if you brine a turkey, it's very difficult to come out with a dry turkey. You're going to have a moist turkey, and whatever spices you've used in the brine will be infused into the meat of the turkey.
So when you did the strongest and most, you know, like intense flavors that you've done was the sage, this one. I was really surprised the last trick you did that it just, even though you hadn't sort of lathered it in sage, it just tasted like sage. It was really
well, right. Glorious. When you take it out of the brine, you don't have to do anything. Yeah, I mean, you can. You should probably put the before you put
stuff
it in the oven.
The cavity.
You stuff the cavity. You don't need to put any salt on it because it's already salted all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
But you stuff the cavity. You maybe pour some butter over it so it browns really nice in the top. But you don't need to do all the machinations that you do if you didn't brine. Like, you know, really rush in and make sure you have tinfoil covering the turkey so it doesn't.
Dry out.
Right. You have a lot more freedom in what you can do, I think. And then we're gonna have what else besides the turkey?
Well, we were thinking of wrapping asparagus spears and bacon and puff pastry.
Yeah, I saw that. We saw that.
We saw that on Facebook. So we might do that.
And now that we can have einkorn bread, now we have bread with einkorn, we can do that.
We're gonna make bread. For sure. This is going to be like the first bread-laden Thanksgiving in a long time.
Yeah,
I think we're going to probably just like put a coat of bread on everything that we do. Maybe not. Maybe that's extreme. But and I really think that I'm going to have to indulge in the apple dumpling question. And I know it's going to make some people upset and sad. But I've decided that my happiness is more important than the happiness of the children. So I'm going to do that.
I think the children would have cereal for Thanksgiving.
That's true. We could just let them have
McDonald's for Thanksgiving.
Captain Crunch. And yeah, I don't.
So that's not going to happen.
We're not doing this for them. really. If we did the dinner for them, we would be all sad. So we're doing it for ourselves. I mean, they're invited, right, of course.
Yeah. But they're not going to ruin it by whining. We don't have children whining at the table.
Yeah, right? That's so true. So, and I think we're probably going to just have the, I don't know. I really want to do something new with potatoes, but I don't know what that would
be. Well, I thought we usually have regular white potatoes, both mashed and then we also have roasted. Some roasted. And I do roasted sweet potatoes.
Yeah, those are delicious.
Which I can't wait to make. You just basically do what you would do if you're squaring and then roasting potatoes in the oven, but you do sweet potatoes instead. And the secret to that is leaving in the oven long enough at a high enough temperature. You don't want to take it out until you can see the browning.
Then they're just sort of really succulent.
Yeah, yeah. And you just kind of get this really nice crust on the outside of them.
And then there's...
You want to get some garlic and some butter before you put it in there and just kind of coat them with that and let it soak. Sweet potatoes, this is my personal preference. I think you ruin a sweet potato when you put sugar on it.
Yeah. Because it's naturally sweet, so it really needs salt. The salt brings the sweet out beautifully, just like with dark chocolate or whatever. Or
exactly.
If you add salt to something, it's really glorious. But, yeah, we don't really go in for the marshmallow sweet potato thing. But those are really glorious. They're like little pieces of candy for me, covered in salt.
Vegetable question, what are we going to do for vegetables?
Well, we were going to wrap our asparagus in bacon.
Which kind of defeats the purpose of
vegetables.
I thought we should get some Brussels sprouts too.
Yeah, we usually do that. And those are really, really nice with like paprika.
Now, if you're listening and you hate Brussels sprouts, it's probably because you haven't had Brussels sprouts really well done.
Yeah.
If you're going to make them, you got to cut them in half. You got to take out the outer leaves, cut them in half, and again, you put a sear on them. You got to cook them longer than
you think you should.
Right. Americans, I think, like their vegetables crisp, and with some vegetables like green beans and asparagus, that works. But with
Brussels sprouts, they keep tasting bitter if you don't cook them until they're really
soft on the inside. But you want a hard, seared crust on the outside. And that's like, again, like a candy if you get it.
Yeah, they are. They're addictive. They just can sit there and eat them all day. There's never enough Brussels sprouts at Thanksgiving dinner. That's the great sorrow, is when the leftovers run out. So.
Yeah, that is.
It's going to be a really
tragic. Because you think, oh, wow, we have this huge turkey. We're going to have, a lot of leftovers. But then our children are growing and they're eating.
I know. It's really upsetting. The children are eating now. Yeah. We have three children. No, we really have four children who eat. And it's really tragic. So, well, I think, is there anything else?
Homemade eggnog. I'll make some homemade eggnog.
Oh, you're going to make eggnog.
Cookies.
You're going to make cookies?
I think I'll make some cookies.
So we're going to, I think I'm going to work out this morning. And I might begin sort of a pre-Thanksgiving fast. Just so that I'm not ill at the end of this week, because
I'm going to be shoveling the snow.
Oh, so you
that's
don't have
my
to
workout
that's
right
be
there.
Workout.
Yeah, we have a mega driveway. That means
and you didn't clean out the garage before the snow, so our car is covered in snow.
Yeah, it's going
to
be awesome.
It's really devastating. We've not had to deal with that in about 7 or 8 years. So,
I hope you all have a good Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And happy Advent. I just want you to know that if you decorate for Christmas before December 23rd, you're not really a Christian. And you should feel bad about
yourself.
You
brood of vipers.
Yeah. Get your priorities straight here. No, recognize heresy where it really exists. And that's in decorating. Actually, we're probably going to decorate before December 23rd, aren't we?
Yeah, our church is because we have.
Yeah, we can't do it on the 23rd because we're busy. So we'll be doing it on December 11th, which is so wrong. So wrong. And cuts us out of Anglicanism, probably. So.
I don't care.
You're a bad person. So thank you so much for listening, and we will be back next week.